one other thing that I noticed from your experience is that there are appropriate tools that you leveraged. You know, you didn't just use pick and mix a selection of different things. You just focused on what tools you had at your disposal, like Canvas and Zoom that you were using, and what were some of the features of those that you could, enable and use to be true to these principles of kind of that learning community and that friendliness and being more sociable in the sense that students feel welcome as part of that whole thing.
You just mentioned that, you know, I don't seem to be afraid to jump in. And I would actually say, if anything, it's more the opposite. I definitely feel nervous in an excited way, but some very much in a scared way as well sometimes, you know, when I try new things in the classroom. I don't know how long I've been teaching for now. I don't have a PhD in maths, but a while. And I still feel nervous, you know, before most classes. And I think that's also what gives me a rush afterwards. But I really love the proverb, and I'm sorry, I don't remember the Māori off the top of my head, but that idea of feel the fear and do it anyway. And I try and say that to my students, especially in Latin, where we've started doing some speaking together. And, you know, I say, I know this can be a bit nerve-wracking and you might make mistakes, and that's okay. We're going to feel the fear and we're going to do it anyway, because that's how we learn. So yeah, to anyone listening, I definitely have, you know, fear and kind of nerves about, you know, are these buddy groups going to work? Is it going to work okay to do a discussion group as a tutorial? You know, how do I, oh my gosh, this peer review function in Canvas doesn't do what I want it to do. How am I going to tell the students? How am I going to scaffold this? So I definitely, you know, have those kind of concerns and fears. And I just figure that I know that a lot of things already don't work in the model of education that I was trained in. So I figure that if I do something and I make a mistake, it's probably not going to be worse than just going into a classroom and talking at someone for 60 minutes and then getting them to write an essay for 50% of their grade, which was a little bit of what some of the pedagogy I was exposed to. Not all, but some of the pedagogy I was exposed to. And just in terms of what you were saying about that social presence, I definitely in semester two, one of the first things I did when I went into the classroom was talk to the students about their lockdown experience. And said, look, you know, I'm probably just being paranoid, I'm probably just being crazy, but here's our backup plan if we end up online. Here's what I'm going to try to do to create that sense of community and connection. And here's how I'll communicate with you and here's how it will work. Let's hope we don't have to kind of pull that parachute. But as it turned out, we did have to. And I think they seemed to respond quite well to talking about that. You know, I didn't want to make them anxious or make them worried, but I wanted them to know that it was something I had thought about, so they didn't have to worry about it in a way.
And they were kind of socialized into that idea that, you know, in case we have to kick in plan B, we would. Yeah. And they actually were clear about what plan B was. So that's what I was saying, like that kind of is the embodiment of that ARCO principle of, you know, learner and teacher working together. So you were kind of laying down the expectations, you were relating the expectations to them in a way that they would then know, you know, there's nothing, no surprises along the way. They totally knew if something happens like a lockdown, then they would be plan B. And they felt supported and encouraged to participate, you know, in either plan, or whether it's plan A or plan B. So in both ways. So it's kind of, I think, even with any new technology, making expectations really clear and being explicit about, you know, if something is experimental, in case it fails, then students are more conducive to, you know, trying that together than the surprise element where, you know, you're introducing something or you just formatting something in a different, using a different mode and then repackaging the same content. So that becomes a bit more difficult for students to cope with because they're used to a particular style in maybe a face-to-face environment.
There was something I wanted to add about Manaakitanga, if that was okay, just while you were talking before about the students having quite sort of a positive attitude towards things, especially in semester one, where by that point, a lot of the students had survived through that first semester with me, either in that classics course or Latin. Not all of them, but quite a few. So it's kind of felt like we were quite bonded, or to me, that's how it felt. But something I just wanted to say about Manaakitanga, and I guess this doesn't relate to technology specifically, but I felt like this was really important, is that I made a decision in semester one and then I kept it up in semester two, which for me was an expression of Manaakitanga. I don't know if other people would agree, which is when I saw the pressure that one I was under and my colleagues were under, and starting to hear pretty much immediately about the pressure that students were under during lockdown, and just being very aware that this was a crisis and was unprecedented and was going to have all sorts of knock-on effects on people's work and employment and mental health and physical health and caring responsibilities, all that sort of stuff, I basically said to the students straight away, I'm going to put a pause on the assessment schedule and we're going to push things back. And then if you need more time to do an assessment, you let me know. And here is my extension policy as of now. If you write to me and ask for an extension, I will give you an extension. Because I trust that you know what's going on with your life and you know what you can manage. And I want you to be able to succeed in this course and pass this course and achieve whatever your academic goals are. But now we have to balance all this other stuff. And that's sort of what I said in semester one. And that obviously happened off the cuff just as things unfolded spontaneously. So when I came back in semester two, I actually sort of framed that quite explicitly at the start of semester. I now talk to students about the ACOR kind of philosophy and I say, this is how I like to approach teaching. You can tell me how you like to approach being a student and we'll sort of work together. But really early on, I basically said to them, my policy, you know, these days is if you need an extension, you know, ask me. I said, because, you know, we all know now that there are in some places really long waiting times and waiting lists for certain kind of specialists now or medical appointments or, you know, social care or social work kind of things. There are all sorts of run-on effects that we're all still experiencing. I hope that now some of those have died down, but in semester two, I think we were still feeling the effects. And I basically said, I trust you. I trust that you respect me and that, you know, you're not going to lie to me. You're just going to say, if this is happening, I need an extension. And I found that worked quite well. I did have quite a lot of students submit work, I guess technically late, but I think that it generated a lot more people passing the course than it would have otherwise.
And would you say, let's just be clear, when we're thinking about inclusive practices, it's not just the understanding of those principles and being aware of those Indigenous knowledge and approaches. I think it's also about the mode that we're teaching in and how do we adapt. You know, you mentioned something around support. So seeking the right advice and making sure we have a right understanding of the concepts that we're trying to embed in our teaching. And also features of platforms and tools. You know, sometimes we have university-driven tools and there other times we have open source tools that we utilize in our own kind of practice. So I think one of the things that's really important to mention is, you know, inclusive design does not happen all at once. It happens kind of, it's a gradual process. So it's like adapting and experimenting and then coming to a level, a kind of an optimum level of teaching and learning practice or principles that work both for the students and you as well as the discipline. And there are some workload issues, of course, and technical competence. Like you mentioned, you're taking a course to learn more about online pedagogies. So, yeah, so that also highlights an important aspect of kind of moving or making this transition to online learning or remote learning or distance blended, whatever we want to call it. There are technical issues like technical competence and capacity, but also workload. How do you set time aside? So sometimes, you know, what I feel from your experiences, you invested a lot of time and effort and resources in the beginning to kind of set it all up. And then now it's basically running and you are kind of making small adjustments along the way. Would you say that's right?
I think yes and no. I mean, one thing that I found was that in semester one, in that big course where I had these GTAs, we did a lot of things to try and embed these values in and these practices, and they did take a lot more time, both for me but also for the GTAs. And I don't think that's sustainable, you know, so that's really tricky is working out, okay, well maybe X, Y, and Z practices are a good way of embedding some of these values, but who's going to resource them? Or what are we going to cut time-wise so that we can resource those things? So I don't necessarily feel like I now have everything set up. If anything, I feel like 2020 showed me, mostly through talking to other teachers and going to different fora about teaching and learning and technology and starting to investigate myself doing courses in online design. If anything, it taught me how many tools there are out there that I have never used or have only used patchily or might be able to use, and also how much support and training I need to be able to do them. So I definitely feel like I'm now at the start of probably a relatively long journey, you know, a couple of years of now going through each of my courses and trying to think about the technological aspects that I could be about technologies where I could be more, you know, making sure that inclusivity is part of the design, or maybe where there are technologies that I should start using because they allow inclusivity for in ways that, you know, on-campus experiences don't necessarily. I personally, and I'll just come back to the idea of training and resourcing, I personally think that it's incumbent on the university as our employer to provide to all academics training units on inclusive teaching, on technologies, and on the combination of the two. So I spent quite a bit of time last year looking for a course that I could take that was specifically on inclusivity and the online learning environment. And as far as I know, we don't offer anything like that. And when I say we don't offer, what I mean is as a staff member, I don't have access to anything like that. And I really think that, you know, there are a lot of people in the university, including high up, who I think genuinely care about inclusivity and diversity, including using technology to make more inclusive classroom spaces or make more inclusive assessment practices. And I think that care now needs to be resourced for all academics and all GTAs, because, I mean, I've been doing this for over a decade and I try really hard to think about inclusivity, but then I'll have a student come up and say, well, I've got such and such learning impairment and here's the recommendation for how we treat it. And it's not something I've encountered before, so I hadn't thought about it. And I could have been incorporating those practices for a decade, but nobody, you know, there's only so much you can find out on your own in the time you have. I think we need to be trained as a collective so that as a collective we are all leveling up, so that it's not just about one person in one department stumbling across a good practice or stumbling across a good app, or one person in one faculty providing excellent training, but another faculty might not have that support staff.
That actually is a perfect way to end the podcast, because first of all, you are highlighting all these issues that we absolutely need to address. And I'm hoping that through this Tellout project, we kind of even start having these kinds of conversations so people become aware of these kind of limitations or challenges, as well as the opportunities. And I agree, like there is so much to be done in preparation of making any kind of transition from one particular mode of teaching to another, let alone kind of emergency remote teaching. So it's really, I think it's really important to have those kinds of conversations. So I will urge those who are listening to this podcast, if they've had similar experiences or if they've got something to share around inclusive teaching and learning using technologies and how they've created equitable learning opportunities for their students, then they should, you know, share it. So, there is something to be said about learning through sharing these experiences as well as through professional development. So I'm hoping that this project, to a certain extent, meets that demand and kind of makes people feel comfortable about talking about these kinds of limitations and challenges and not just the good stuff that happens. So thank you so much for your time.
That's okay. Thank you so much for having me. And I hope that this is useful to some of you listening. And I hope that I get to learn from your experience as well as from the professional training that we hope is coming. Thanks.